Have you ever longed to escape reality? Or fantasized about stepping into someone else's shoes, even for just a little while? Hi, I'm Laura Mullen.
And I'm Chris Tolley. We host CBC's Play Me, the immersive podcast that transforms theater into addictive audio fiction. Join us for a new season and disappear into a world rich with drama, where every show delivers hypnotizing stories and unveils intriguing characters with secrets.
Play Me, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Eleanor Wachtel, and this is Writers and Company. Today, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright and novelist Ead Akhtar. His deeply personal latest book, Homeland Elegies, blends fact and fiction, memoir and political engagement. Ead Akhtar was born in 1970 on Staten Island, New York. His parents, both doctors, met as medical students in Lahore, Pakistan, and immigrated to the U.S. just 2 years before Ead's birth through a State Department program designed to attract scientific talent. When Ead was four, the family moved to Wisconsin, to a suburb of Milwaukee, where he grew up. Later, he majored in theater at Brown University in Rhode Island, and then got an M.A. in film at Columbia in New York. For a time, he studied acting with the innovative Polish director Jerzy Grotowski and worked as an assistant to the French-American director and writer André Gregory. Ead Akhtar himself is an actor and filmmaker, as well as an author. His first novel, American Dervish, is an autobiographical coming-of-age story, narrated by a Pakistani-American boy from a secular household who becomes very religious. It was published in more than 20 languages and named one of the best books of 2012. Around the same time, Akhtar came out with his Pulitzer Prize-winning drama, Disgraced, a provocative, powerful exploration of race and culture in post-9/11 America. He followed it with other challenging plays, including The Invisible Hand and Junk, set amidst the greed of the financial world of 1980s Wall Street. In 2020, when Ead Akhtar published his second novel, Homeland Elegies, it was a kind of summa of his previous writing. As one critic put it, it's hard to convey the breadth and brilliance of this work. Exploiting his skills as playwright and essayist as well as novelist, Akhtar depicts an immigrant family's experience of the American dream through a son's relationship with his father and dissects the erosion of truth, decency, and hope in a nation shaped by debt and money. Needless to say, it's intensely autobiographical, with its narrator named Ead Akhtar. The novel was on many Best Book of the Year lists and won an American Book Award. It's currently in development for a series at FX. I spoke to Ead Akhtar in the fall of 2020 from his home in New York. Family is at the heart of your new novel, Homeland Elegies, especially the relationship between father and son. What makes this such rich terrain for you?
Wow. That's a good question. It's a big question. I think that requires a level of self-awareness that I'm going to try to fake here. I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, as an immigrant son, as an eldest son of an immigrant family, the first, you know, my parents were both the first to leave their countries from their families respectively. There's a lot of expectation and a lot of investment in what there was in me, a lot of love. And I think that the decisions that I made in my life, you know, I think they were very consequential for my parents, and the consequences on my parents were obviously very consequential on me. And the decision to become a writer, which really wasn't so much a decision as it was a kind of inevitability, when I had a high school teacher in my sophomore year of high school who really changed my life, and I never looked back. I never wanted to do anything else but be committed to stories and writing and all of that sort of stuff. You know, from that point forward, I think it was a long journey, sort of my parents kind of understanding what it was I was getting into and what it was all about. And then, you know, the next level of it, which was writing about them and writing about what we had all been through in various forms, whether, you know, it was novels or plays or whatever it was that I've written over the years. beyond that, I had a larger than life father. I mean, he was, I remember encountering Falstaff in Henry IV's parts 1 and 2 for the first time and feeling like, oh yeah, I've got a beat on that character. He's a lot like my dad, actually. So, I think that there was just he was a man of very, very large appetites, and I experienced so much of what the world was through him and through his experiences. So, I think there's some particularities, just the fact of the parents that I had, their dramatic natures, if you will, and on the other hand, my position within the sort of immigrant family, if you will.
Can you tell me a little about your father's background, the world that shaped him?
Sure. My dad grew up in a very rural and rugged part of northern Pakistan. And his family was the only really sort of like highly educated family in that area. His dad had been sent to the tribal areas as a kind of supervisor of agricultural education. And so they were Punjabis living in a very sort of non-Punjabi atmosphere. But my dad kind of grew up, he often used to say to me, if I had more to do with bringing you up, you wouldn't be so sheltered. He really grew up on the streets, if you will. So it was a very wily and kind of canny person, but was also came from a family of sort of, a lot of education generation after generation. He ended up becoming a doctor and was top of his class in the late 60s and came over to America on a program that at the time, it was post-Kennedy, the quotas had changed for South Asians coming to the United States, and the U.S. State Department was looking for engineers and doctors and scientific talent. So he came over on a program that gave him a visa, a plane ticket, an apartment, and a job. And my mom came over on the same program. She was 2 years behind him in medical school. So they came in the late 60s, and my dad ended up, he always says fortuitously, in the first laboratory that was focused on heart arrhythmias. It was pacemaker technologies and all of that sort of stuff really, came from the few people that came out of that laboratory in Staten Island. And after a few years at that lab, he was invited to open a laboratory carte blanche, the first of its kind in the Midwest, at the University of Wisconsin, where he ended up going on to become one of the world's premier sort of specialists of arrhythmia technology and whatnot. So it was a real, it was a real American journey in a lot of ways, a lot of success and also a kind of darker side. My dad was, as I said earlier, had larger than life appetites. And, towards the end of his life, it really took a toll on him.
Well, as you've described him, he was, extraordinary, generous, brilliant, but also tortured. I mean, a sort of self-made, self-styled businessman, entrepreneur, doctor, but he had his demons. He drank, gambled, had affairs, made and lost 2 fortunes. What do you think drove him?
It's hard to say. He was a man of such enormous paradoxes. He started the largest, what would end up becoming the largest cardiology group in the state of Wisconsin. And, they were doing billions of dollars in business. And so on the one hand, here's this incredibly sort of fair-minded, very, very leadership-oriented, cared about the nurses and cared about everybody, all the way down, the techs, the doctors, the patients. And on the other hand, somebody who, as you said earlier, made and lost 2 fortunes and gambled, and it's all kinds of weird paradoxes throughout the course of my dad's career, course corrections, and I think that my dad was, he had a kind of penchant for some of the darker things in life, but he also was an incredibly noble person, and I think my understanding of dramatic character, my ability to sort of nest contradiction and brook contradiction within the understanding of a person really comes in a large part from studying my father so closely. I mean, being around somebody who embodied so many contradictory impulses over the years.
I know. I mean, I was reading somewhere that when you talk about Noble, that he once essentially gave his Audi to the valet at a favorite restaurant, sold it to him for $1.
Oh my God. He did that kind of stuff all the time. One year, he rented out the largest theater in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, called the Pabst Theater, this Old Glory down in downtown. And it's a 3,000-some-seat theater, and rented it out and flew Ravi Shankar into Milwaukee to give a free concert to the people of Milwaukee. And so the house was filled to the gills, and my dad gets up on stage, and he says, this man you are going to hear, he is a god, he's a living god. If I hear any of you talking during this concert, I will hang you from the ceiling. So he says this to 3,000 people, right, on stage as a way of introduction to Ravi Shankar, and then proceeds to go out into the hallway and yap through the entire first half of the concert on a cell phone. I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
if Falstaff is your model, I mean, what's a poor writer to do?
Exactly. You know, there are few characters that contain those kinds of contradictions and have, such an extraordinarily generous man, but also, at the end of his life, as the father in the book, who's obviously largely based on my dad, drops $2 million in a local casino in a year. You know, it's like almost no thought to, in a way, what would that money have, how could that have benefited others? And I don't mean myself. I didn't, that was not in my thought process. But, it's just one of those things where, it's just they're hard contradictions to square. And what is the thing, what's the prime number that at the root of all that? I don't know. I'll keep turning that question over. It's the first time anybody's asked me that question, actually. So in a way, it's the first time I've asked that question so directly of myself.
Was he ever content, do you think?
In moments, I think, he loved to fish and he loved, if Green Bay was winning a football game, he was really happy. And, I think he found a unique and very intense pleasure from some of my success that I have, had in the last 10 years or so. But I think it was all passing. I think he was not somebody who was necessarily, he was not hunting happiness. But I think he was somebody whose unhappiness hunted him a little bit. And maybe if he had been more willing to sort of attend to his own happiness, maybe the end wouldn't have been so hard for him.
In your novel, the father is called upon to treat Donald Trump back in the 1990s and becomes an ardent supporter of Trump when he enters politics. What did he admire in him?
Well, in the book, the father, who is, as I said earlier, largely based on my own dad, spends this time with Trump in the mid-90s, treating him part of a cohort of doctors that are taking care of some heart rhythm issues that Trump is having in the book. And he has this, he has this exposure to a kind of certain vision of American life, a kind of glamour, an ersatz glamour that shimmers all the more powerfully because it's so shallow in a way. The access to, the helicopter rides from, from the heliport to Trump Tower or whatever kind of access to the Robin Leach version of the lifestyles of the rich and famous in America, like that form of the American dream, which, of course, we know in Trump's case has, been fueled by, gargantuan amounts of debt. And Rich ultimately is, gossamer thin. But in the book, my father falls for this vision of American success, this kind of individualism on steroids, if you will, debt-fueled and released from the consequences of anything, truth or debt or history or whatever. And, I think that relationship that I portray in the book is at the root of the kind of I'm trying to get at the emotional core of what the American fascination is with this kind of pursuit of wealth, even if it's totally false, right? Because I think that at root, that's part of what Trump's appeal has been. It's been this performance of however many, decades now where he performs success and we or many of us sort of fall for the performance. And even if we have a sense that the performance isn't quite the reality, we like the performance so much that we don't care, and I think that gap between illusion and reality is something that's kind of taken over our culture in so many ways and is, of course, at root the formal device of my novel, because many readers spend so much time wondering what's real and what's not real.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to ask you that because I was carefully saying that in the novel, the father, you know, without asking if that was your father, and you mine your own experience for your work, both plays and novels. And in Homeland Elegies, the line is especially blurred because the narrator bears your name and shares much of your story. What made you want to tease or confound the reader in this way?
Well, it seemed to me that you know, it was a complex moment, and one of the complexities of being a writer of fiction in this moment was recognizing how the audience's attention is shifting and how the window of the reader's concentration is narrowing and how that intense focus on the present has become habituated to a light from thing to thing, from discrete fragment of information to discrete fragment of information, without the through line of an argument, without the through line of a narrative. Because, you know, the social media platforms, whether it's Instagram or Twitter, or whether it's breaking news on television, seem to be curating our pleasure principle in this particular way, to be focused intensely on what's happening right now, almost to the exclusion of any bigger picture. So recognizing that was a kind of formal reality that I was going to be dealing with on the one hand. And on the other, the idea that fiction, at least in my hands, I couldn't imagine a third-person novel or a obviously first-person fictional narrator who could get there. I couldn't get my arms around the crazy political realities that have unfolded in this country. You know, reality, or so-called quote-unquote reality, has outpaced fiction's capacity to deal with it. And invariably, whatever I was to write, the extent to which it was going to have a political bent or political nature, was going to feel like satire. And it felt to me like I just didn't want to write satire. This is a very serious moment. The consequences of our lust for unreality are profound and serious. I wanted to write a serious book that addressed the realities and the philosophical conundrums of where we are. I wanted to write a philosophical novel that had all of the addictive thrill of reality television, because that's the only place I felt that I could go ultimately to make sense of what was happening. You know, and then the last piece of it really was that I think I see the dominant narrative mode of our moment as the self. Everybody is curating the image of the self and presenting it to others and sort of curating it for their own sake. You know, we are increasingly relating to the world and processing experience through the narrative of what does it mean for me? Who's listening to me? When is my story going to get out there? Et cetera, et cetera. You know, this idea that the self is central is more central than anything else. So that too was part of it, you know, staging the self, the narrator narrating his or her own experience, and doing it in a way that collapsed fact and fiction so that it could, in a way, make a place for the prurient sensationalism that I knew I would have to include in the book to keep the reader's attention.
So you didn't want to write memoir because you wanted the freedom of expanding or making it more sensational or seducing.
I wouldn't have known how to write a memoir. I'm a dramatic writer. I thrive on contradiction and opposition. I thrive on the sharp edge. I thrive on the swift narrative turn. I thrive on all of the formal constraints of strong dramatic storytelling, moving characters from one pole to the opposite. The habits of my mind would have been so constrained by a need to hew to the actual facts. You know, it just, I wouldn't have even known how to do it. You know, I had to forget my life, if you will, in order to write the book, and then just pilfer and pillage from my own life and those of my parents in order to tell this tale. And the tale I'm telling is the tale of America, you know. And so ultimately, it was less important to remain accurate to the actual events of my life or my parents' lives, because I was asking the reader to hold this story to a different standard of truth, a higher, more metaphorical standard of whether or not it could account for the dilemmas that have engulfed us as a nation.
Because the novel opens boldly with a letter addressed to America, an overture, and there's an urgency and energy to it right off the top. Where did that come from? I mean, the inspiration for the book, the vision behind it, because it's not just the family's experience as immigrants to the U.S. I mean, that's at the core, but the theme of the novel is so much bigger than that.
Yeah. I was in Rome And I was at the American Academy in Rome, and you know, my mother had recently passed away, and my father was, as I said, showing signs of, you know, demise, imminent demise, almost daily dramas around his drinking and whatnot. And, you know, Trump was our president. And, you know, I had been watching what was happening in the state of Wisconsin, where I'm from, for quite some time, the sort of devolution of our politics and the increasing temperature of the social body. You know, it's almost like the country was in a fever. And I was disturbed on the one hand by everything that I was seeing, much of which was not a surprise to me because I felt that it had been observing it for some time. And to me, a lot of the changes that had been unfolding in American life, these divides between urban and rural and heartland and the coasts and the economic divides, the racial divides, these were a long time in the making. And the ideology around money and finance, to me, has been an important part of that story, which has been hard to tell because everybody wants to hear some story about identity. They want to hear how inequality, you know, racial or identity inequality is really at root the disease that's plaguing the republic, which I don't think is the case. I think that's a problem, but it's not the fatal illness that's choking us. But anyway, so I've been trying to think about how to write about all of this for some time, and I was at the American Academy, as I said, and I came across a poem by Leopardi, written, you know, some 200 years ago, entitled "To Italy." And I remember thinking as I was reading the poem, you know, he's addressing his fellow Italians and trying to remind them of what they once were and how far they'd fallen and all of that sort of, you know, tropey stuff. But it ignited a thought in me, which was, would it be possible to summon a voice that could address my fellow Americans? And, of course, a very grandiose thought. But I went to bed that night, and the next morning I woke up and the first sentence of this book was already forming itself, and I spent the next few days writing that overture to America, inspired by Leopardi's poem "To Italy." So, you know, that set in motion the writing, which just flowed from that point forward, an exploration of America from the perspective of a family that had been here for a half century, and a narrator who was the son of immigrants who was not just preoccupied by his station in life and his parents' station in life, but by trying to understand what had gone wrong with the republic, if you will.
Homeland Elegies is not about being Muslim in America, but you say that's a useful vantage point, maybe even a privileged one, to look at what's become of the country. How so?
Well, I think that being Muslim in America is an interesting perspective because on the one hand, you know, post 9/11, I think a lot of the fault lines, a lot of the sort of overt notions of belonging and the kind of consequences of being on the wrong side of those fault lines are, of course, clear. You know, they're not, it's not exclusive to Muslims. I think that, you know, minorities of all sorts go through that experience. But I think that married to a perspective within the country and having that perspective being here, there's also the perspective of the very vivid consequences of American foreign policy. You know, we as Muslims from living in this country have family members across the planet whose lives have been deeply informed, affected, and in often cases ended by American intervention in the world because of the aftermath of 9/11. And I think that one of the unfortunate realities of American life is that even 19 years later, we still, as Americans, seem to have so little understanding of what 9/11, where it came from, what it was about, and what it has meant for us, and how we, in our inability to process the wound in any meaningfully productive way, have gone about and set about sort of inflicting the wound on others. And I think that the combination of that sort of inter and intra perspective, the within the country and without the country perspective on American identity and what American strength or the American persona has meant, and what that can give you a pretty whole picture of what America has become. You know, one of the central strands of this is the destruction of the world order initiated by the United States. Endless wars, many of which were nonsensical in terms of the genesis of, you know, really coming from 9/11. But they did. They emanated from that need for vengeance, that need for responding in that way. So that's, you know, when I talk about, you know, perhaps being Muslim in America is a privileged perspective in order to understand America in the 21st century, that's really what I'm getting at.
Ayad Akhtar, I wanted to talk a little more about your family and upbringing, which you draw on in the novel. You've talked about your father's outsized personality and appetites. Your mother was very different, and their relationship was a difficult one. What were some of the issues between them?
I think my mom was she was definitely a much more reserved person and enjoyed a quiet life, which she almost never had with my dad. You know, she was a contemplative person. She was very philosophical, if you will. You know, loved to read Marcus Aurelius and Balthazar Gracian, and liked to be sitting around with her sons talking about things rather than out sort of doing something like my dad always wanted to be, you know. So he would always chide me and my brother about staring at paper all day long, meaning we were reading, you know, and didn't understand what it was we were finding in books that was more fun than what you could find out in the world. And that paradox, the sort of, you know, interior versus exterior, or sort of bookish versus worldly, those are the polarities that I grew up with, very much embodied by my parents. And my mom, you know, whereas my dad, I think, believed for, you know, and did, you know, actually thrive for quite some time in this country. You know, I think my mom always felt that she couldn't understand what was so great about this country. She had given up so much to be here, and she wasn't sure that it was worth the trade-off, and spent a good part of her life, I think, homesick in various ways. And I think it's probably the story of a lot of immigrants, you know, who miss home, who never find a sense of belonging in their new countries. But though they make good lives, perhaps, or they come here to sacrifice for, you know, for their kids or whatnot. So, yeah, I mean, and that was the portrait of the binary that's very much also in the book, but it was represented in my life, too.
And did you feel more your mother's son, or
my dad definitely thought I was more my mom's son, and my mom definitely thought I was more my dad's son.
Oh, I see.
It was a constant struggle. I mean, anytime, you know, my dad was a little bit more accepting of me being my mom's son, but my mom really just, she couldn't countenance the ways in which I resembled my dad.
Well, your mother had gone through a lot. I mean, she had witnessed the horrors of partition. What happened to her?
Well, again, you know, in the book, my mom, as in real life, she was born before partition, as was my father. And my mother also did actually come from a part of Pakistan where there was a lot of violence. And, you know, those early scenes of partition, which are iconic, the sort of extraordinarily horrific, gruesome things that folks would see at the train stations of dead bodies, you know, chopped up bodies being unloaded from trains that were bringing people from India to Pakistan and sort of going that direction, you know, Hindu mobs that would board the trains and kill all the Muslims, and going the other direction, you know, Muslim mobs killing all the Hindus. And so this sort of the level of violence was, you know, extraordinary. And it's an important part of the story of Pakistan and India, and one that continues to play out. You know, it's one that folks often don't know much about. In fact, many times don't even know that Pakistan and India were once one country, and not so long ago, actually. So, you know, all of that is part and parcel of the mother's perspective on life in America. You know, one of the challenges with writing this book, which I was writing, it was an American tale, an American story, and a portrait of this country. But in order to tell that story, I had to account for the one who was telling it, meaning myself. And in order to account for my perspective and my point of view, I had to account for the history that made me. And so part of that history is partition, because it's what made my parents. Partition is an important part of their makeup. And so that's passed on to me one way or the other.
But in connection with your mother, and I think this is something you've said about your mother rather than something I've got from the book, you've mentioned post-colonial rage. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that is often, I get a lot of grief for any time I talk about this with any granularity, but Islamist views have had much deeper support in the Muslim world than people understand or realize. And, you know, part of the mischaracterization or the misconstrual of what Islamist views ultimately some of the political valences of those views, what those are about. You know, I think that folks in the West really don't seem to understand their own participation in all of this stuff. It's as if, you know, we're over here just living our lives, and, you know, we're drinking our beers and enjoying our lives, and then we got these people, they're so angry, and they come along and they just mess it up for us, and they want to. That's not history. that's a perspective, and that's a perspective that is, you know, of course, profoundly uninformed. And I think that, I mean, this is not new, but I think the West is finally beginning to see a consolidated pushback against the heritage of colonialism, the despoiling of the so-called colonies for centuries. It's impossible to imagine the Enlightenment, say, this movement that has changed the world allegedly for the better, without sort of understanding how much it's predicated on rubber and sugar and slave trade. And, you know, what conclusions to draw from that are up for debate, whether or not restitution should be made or whatnot. But what we can certainly recognize without there being any question or any controversy is that these policies, rightful or wrongful, have long-term emotional impacts on cultures. And there is a current of still burning post-colonial resentment across the planet. And so in the book, my mother says some pretty nasty things about America, and then those nasty things get quoted verbatim by another character in a play that I write. And then, of course, I'm trying to account for the fact that everyone's always asking me, is that what you think? Because everyone's trying to figure out where am I in these narratives. And so it's a kind of a puzzle, if you will, to try to explain the mysterious alchemy by which lived experience gets transformed into art. But yeah, speaking specifically to the question, you know, if my father is in the book a kind of adherent or lover of Donald Trump, then my mother in a way drifts much closer to Bin Laden than she does to Donald Trump. And between those two poles, between these two visions of America, one predatory and the other a kind of limitless franchise, that's where the narrator sits, in between those two poles.
I'm Nahla Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time, and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Your mother was sick for much of your childhood, and she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer just as you were starting school and battled numerous recurrences. How do you think that affected your relationship?
Oh, that's a good question. I've thought a lot about that, and I think done some therapy about it too. I feel like I have, but it's hard. I think when you're a kid, and this is stuff that I'm speaking above my pay grade here, I don't know. But I think that when you're very young and you're worried that your mom may not be with you, it may shut you down to some things. You know, it may protectively or preemptively make you less inclined to want to attach to that mother and maybe to other people as well. That would certainly account for certain tendencies that I've experienced in my personal life in that regard. And I do think that early fear of loss, which kept recurring throughout my childhood, probably formed me substantially.
Could you read from the novel? This is a scene with your mother, or your alter ego's mother, near the end of her life when she was 72.
Sure. One of the final proper conversations I had with her while she was still mostly in possession of all her wits and with her habitual reserve softened by the approaching end was about Pakistan or our respective relationships to it. She was sitting up nibbling on a piece of freshly made laddu from the sizable new Indo-Pak grocery that had opened a couple of miles west of us in a strip mall behind the new casino that now sat where, when I was a child, there'd been a middle school. She was munching on that piece of besan laddu, its beige crumble adhering to her lips, when suddenly she stopped chewing. Her mouth sagged, her eyes welled, her
Her voice quivered with sudden regret.
I'm so sorry, Mary John.
For what, Mom? You don't have anything to be sorry about.
You were so happy there.
Where?
Back home. You were always so happy back home.
I paused, moved. With her end in view, her emotions had never been so clear, her face never as radiant. In moments like these, her beauty was heartbreaking.
Why are you apologizing? I never saw you like that here.
I don't know, Mom. No, she said with an endearing firmness. I never did. And then all at once, shifting.
You didn't know that?
What?
That you were happier when you were there?
I smiled to hold her attention as I considered. The most vibrant of my childhood memories were those of life in my father's village and of the interlocking rooms in my mother's family's sprawling Rawalpindi bungalow. I loved being there, but I never pined for it when we returned, not like she did. As a young boy, I often remarked how much happier she was when we were in Pakistan. I used to pray to God for her to be happy like that in America, too. I was happy you were happy, Mom. It was nice to be with family.
It was, wasn't it?
And it was nice to not be in school.
You didn't like school, she said, frowning playfully.
No, I didn't.
I'm sorry.
That you made me go to school?
No,
she moaned, her face collapsing with sudden despair. What is it, Mom?
I'm sorry we brought you here.
Mom, I've had a good life here. She stared at me for a long moment, as if confused.
You have?
I'm happy. Her forehead creased with sudden concern.
I don't think so.
I am. I've always been a little serious, right? Isn't that what you say?
Too serious.
But it doesn't mean I'm not happy.
Strange happiness.
I get to do what I love. I'm a writer. Can you believe it? I smiled. I'm happy. She studied me for a moment, her head cocked cutely, a loving tenderness pouring into her eyes.
That makes me happy, she said finally.
Then, almost as an afterthought, she added,
I never really liked it here.
I know, Mom.
You do?
She seemed both surprised and pleased to hear it. I nodded. Then her expression changed again abruptly, narrow with a troubled thought. What is it? I asked.
Don't be mad.
About what?
You're one of them now. Write about them. Don't write about us.
Ayad Akhtar reading a scene from his new novel, Homeland Elegies. Did it hurt you to hear your mother say you were one of them?
No. No, I think she was encouraging me to, you know, I think one of the things that frustrated her and maybe frustrates me at times was to be pigeonholed always as somebody writing about something that was perceived as other. And, you know, in my own experience, I'm writing about love and greed and family and faith and murder and politics. I just happen to be writing about those things from the perspective of characters that I know, the characters I grew up with, the people I grew up with who happen to be Muslim, happen to be Pakistani immigrants for the most part. But, you know, it's often perceived, or it seems to be sort of identified, that I'm writing from a particular to a particular, as opposed to writing from a particular to a universal. And, you know, I think that has frustrated me, but it probably frustrated my mother even more. You know, she would say, you know, you're not a Muslim writer, you're a writer. You know, I would always say to her, Mom, I'm happy somebody's paying any attention at all. I mean, it's just, I'm grateful that I have a chance to even have the conversation.
Ayad Akhtar, you come from the so-called heartland of America. What was that like for you growing up in Wisconsin in the 1970s and 80s?
I loved Wisconsin. I mean, I still love Wisconsin. I had a lot of good friends. You know, it was a very, very homogenous community, very, very white bread, very, very Lutheran, mostly, you know, Northern European immigrant stock. But it was at the very earliest stages of transforming the area that we were in, earliest stages of transforming from a kind of rural area to an exurb or a, like a beginning of a suburb, if you will. So I just, I grew up with people who were very welcoming and sort of open-hearted, and I grew up with that, and I never really felt excluded. I knew I was different, but in large part, I knew I was different because I knew that we were different. It wasn't that people were making us feel different. You know, and all of that changed after 9/11. And I think that, you know, recently I've seen in the last 10 years that life in Wisconsin has changed a lot. You know, the tensions, the heartland has undergone so much structural change and so much profound structural and stressful change that life has changed. The communal life has changed. There is a breakdown in not just civility, but a kind of open-heartedness that I bemoan or I'm very sad to see happening. But I do recognize it comes from, you know, real suffering. But for the most part, I would say that I loved growing up there. I do feel very much like it's home, even though, you know, the whole question of home is a contested one for me.
Because
I am constantly asked to account for my difference. And I'm constantly described as somebody who is not just American, but Muslim American. And that contrary, the Muslim part of it is a particularly difficult thing for people to conceptualize. You know, seeing the word Muslim is a little bit like hearing the word cancer in this country. And so having to deal with that all the time now for, you know, whatever, 19, 20 years, it just wears on you. It just makes you, you know, it makes you wonder where you can really rest. I don't blame anybody for it. I don't feel personally slighted by individuals who, I recognize the reflex, I recognize the impulse, I understand the social context, but it does have an emotional impact over time. And I think that in my case, I'm fortunate because I get to write about it. But it takes a toll.
When you were growing up, your family made frequent visits home to Pakistan. What impression did that leave on you?
I loved it. The whole notion of being with an extended family is, you know, dozens of cousins and aunts and uncles and, you know, parents, brothers and sisters and both sets of grandparents and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. Those were all experiences that were indissociable for me from Pakistan. You know, I didn't have those experiences outside of that context. So for the homeland, if you will, my parents' homeland was a kind of familial homeland. And so there was a kind of sense of familial belonging, even though from a very young age, it was clear to me I was not Pakistani, that I was a very American kid. And again, you know, didn't bother me. You know, I knew that we would be going back to America and I had school in America and I had friends in America, but I loved being there too. And as I said in the section that I read, the narrator describes, you know, some of his most vivid experiences in his father's village. And those, of course, are my experiences too. But I think, you know, I'm sure it's an experience that folks have when the thing I'm describing as bifurcated is something that's maybe a little bit more unified for folks when, you know, their families are in the same country that they are from.
And partly as a result of those visits to Pakistan, you went through your own religious phase as a child from around age 7. It wasn't something you actually grew up with in your household, but this is a story you tell in your first novel, American Dervish.
Right.
What inspired this?
You know, I think I had a sensitivity to the splendor of creation, maybe as many children do. And I had an active mind at a young age, and I wanted to understand what this grand creation was all about. And there wasn't really anything in my experience that seemed to address that. My parents were particularly religious, and so I wasn't really brought up in the kind of tales of the numinous or of creation or whatever. So I naturally, I think, gravitated to wherever it was going to be able to be found in my context. And I just had some aunts back in Pakistan who were very, who used to tell me those stories about the prophet and whatnot. And, you know, the other example that I often give is when I was 10, I saw The Empire Strikes Back. And, you know, those sequences between Yoda and Luke Skywalker in the swamp, in Dagobah Swamp, those were similar. They addressed the same realm of mystery and splendor. And I remember reading Jonathan Edwards, the great Puritan theologian, had wrote something called Personal Narrative, which is sort of his history of his relationship of coming to God, and writes about his own experiences as a child walking through the fields and feeling the sweetness of the Lord in the flowers and in the trees as a very young boy. And I remember reading Personal Narrative and thinking, wow, yeah, that's very similar to how I – that was my childhood too. So I think it was something devotional about me and something sort of, you know, extra sensitive maybe in that way that was looking for a text to make sense of what this was all about.
And really, Luke Skywalker brought it on too?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Yoda. I know,
I'm being heretical. I know I shouldn't say
no, this. No. You're not being heretical. It really was such a powerful, the articulation, you know, and it was by design, really. As we now know, George Lucas was cribbing from Joseph Campbell and was trying to fashion a myth, you know, a myth for the times that would secure access for an audience to the sacred mystery of life, that's really the goal of the hero's journey.
You say you're no longer a practicing or even believing Muslim, but that Islam is part of your artistic and spiritual inspiration, that you're interested in the Quran as myth and literature, an idea that I think many believers might regard as blasphemous. So
indeed,
how does that approach enrich your appreciation of scripture?
I spend a lot of time reading scripture, whether it's Old Testament or New Testament or, you know, a mainstay in my reading life is Meister Eckhart, and so is Ibn Arabi, the great Muslim mystic from the 13th century. And I find the Quran fascinating. I don't subscribe to it as the preeminent voicing of the Godhead in human language, but that doesn't mean I don't find it a wonderful source of so much of the complexity, the deepest forms of complex human articulation. I mean, if you read the Old Testament, really, it just doesn't get any better in terms of the ability to contain the contradictions that comprise the totality of life itself. There are not a lot of texts that are willing to contain, that are able to contain the extraordinary rhapsodic highs and the extraordinary good that human beings are capable of, and the declivitous and craven evil that we perpetrate. You know, to read the Old Testament is to recognize that at some level, bloodshed is part of our experience, and we will never escape it. And I think that there aren't a lot of texts that are willing to go there, but the sacred texts, the old sacred texts, tend to be the ones that do.
The attacks of September 11th, 2001 were a turning point for you and other Americans of Muslim background. How did you feel the impact of that event?
Overnight. I mean, in addition to the sort of, you know, widespread anxiety, confusion, and fear that I think all Americans felt, I also had the experience of being identified as I often say that before 9/11, well, my mother used to say before 9/11, they had no idea who we were or where we were from. And after 9/11, we could have only been from somewhere bad. So that was a very, you know, real experience that happened. Again, my purpose in articulating that isn't to bemoan it. It's to state it as a fact, because it is a fact. And it contributes to, you know, I would say that maybe the deeper thematic preoccupation of the book of Homeland Elegies is the social construction of the self, the ways in which the society provides the experiences and the discourses and the practices and the attitudes that shape an individual's response to all of that, which becomes the personality, which becomes the interior. So in order to tell that story of the social construction of the self in America at this particular moment, 9/11 was an unavoidable landmark in the landscape, especially for me.
You directly confronted questions of identity and Islamophobia post 9/11 in your play Disgraced through the character of Amir, a corporate lawyer who acknowledges taking a certain pride in the fall of the towers. Disgraced won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 2013, but there were Muslims who saw your critique of Islam as an attack on the faith and community. Has that reaction bothered you?
Yes, I think there's been a long-standing disgruntlement would be a kind word for what a lot of folks feel toward me from my own community. it's hard. It makes me sad. I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what the nature of art or an artist is meant to be doing. I think that when you don't have a lot of representations out there, I think that folks expect that if there's going to be a representation by somebody from the community, it should be positive. And basically what they're hoping for is some, you know, advertising or PR, really. Folks want a role model. They want to feel encouraged about where they come from. I'm not sure that's the job of an artist. I'm not sure it's ever been the job of an artist. But it is obviously a complicated proposition to be writing meaningfully and in complicated ways about where you come from in a culture that's not necessarily inclined to see you as equal to it, right? So in the book, there's a character who quotes Norbert Elias, the great German sociologist. And Norbert Elias, you know, put this beautifully succinctly. He said that the dominant majority fashions its we image from a minority of its best. And it fashions the they image of the despised outsiders from a minority of its worst. And so this is the mechanism whereby 19 hijackers can come to stand in for the totality of a religion, right? An entire religion. Is the dominant majority fashions its image of the outsider from a minority of its worst. And so the extent to which an artist is possibly articulating human frailty and exposing the flawed and contradictory nature of the human condition as experienced by members of his own community, well, those are not seen as the minority of the best struggling with life. It's seen often as the minority of the worst who can't get it right. And, you know, again, is that my problem? You know, I don't know, maybe, but I've never felt that it was my problem. I felt that that was the dominant majority's problem. And I wasn't going to change what it was that I was doing because, you know, eggheads out there didn't seem to be able to understand that I was writing from the particular to the universal. You know, I guess I'm coming back to that question of the particular to the particular. But to me, you know, and I often joke, but there's a lot of truth to it. If I was interested in advertising and public relations, I would have gone into that and made a lot more money doing it. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in a quest for what's real and what's true about human life.
But there's a lot of anger in this play and sadness.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, Disgraced is a howl of rage. I think that was what it was described as in the very first review in the Chicago Tribune, as a howl of rage. I mean, it's not new that an artist is speaking out against the injustice of creation or the injustice of society or the, you know, I mean, we wouldn't litigate James Baldwin's rage. So what's the question? I mean, what, you know, and I don't mean it to you. This is a sort of larger conversation that I'm constantly in the throes of, because somehow to express anger as a member of the despised minority is to echo the minority of the worst. I don't think that's true. I think that's a social mechanism that exists within a society where the dominant majority is not the race or identity that I'm from. And I'm not going to allow or enable that logic to make my art. It's just not where I want to be.
Ead Akhtar, the final... it's not that I just, we're running out of time. I have to go to the next question.
But it's fine. It's all good. I appreciate the chance to speak this openly and honestly about all this stuff. I mean, I can hear the welcome in your questions and in your listening. So it's what enables me to actually say some of this stuff, which I usually just say in my work. I try to avoid saying it on a radio show or, you know, in an interview, because it's almost invariably misconstrued.
To go back to Homeland Elegies, the final chapter is devoted once again to the narrator's father. And as you were saying, that at this point in his life is kind of falling apart because of drinking and gambling and a lawsuit that is destroying his career and so on. But the father is longing to be home.
Yeah.
I think you've acknowledged that your own father was longing to be home. Did that
Yes.
surprise you?
I mean, I suppose in a way it did, you know, in a way it did. Though I think there was a probably an inevitability or an emotional inevitability to it. You know, there were things about Pakistan that he, you know, as much as he sort of like looked down on it, there were things that he never really didn't stop doing. There was certain kind of music that he never stopped listening to. And, you know, he loved Pakistani food in a way that, you know, would make constant fun of every other cuisine and compare it to, you know, North Indian and Pakistani food, which was, you know, the summum bonum. So there were cultural habits that were so deeply ingrained that you know, whatever his love of America was, it was clear that there were certain appetites that were only going to be satisfied by his native experience. And so at the end of his life, when he spoke constantly about wanting to go back to Pakistan after, you know, not saying that at all. I mean, sort of, if anything, making fun of Pakistan much of his adult life in this country, it wasn't really that much of a surprise, but certainly makes for an interesting and evocative and I think deeply meaningful reversal in a dramatic story, because there is a shift there. I think that it does point to the way that America, at least for my two parents, was never really a home. It was a permanent destination, but their home was always somewhere else. And that perhaps there is something about that instability of belonging in the American experience, which seems to happen to so many generation after generation, that being American is about, I suppose, accepting certain ideas as your own, as the important ideas. But for immigrants who come here, being American doesn't mean being home the way that being home meant where they grew up. And that contradiction is never solved. You know, it's maybe less acute for some people than others, but it's never a solved dilemma.
In the coda to the novel, you declare yourself American. You don't want to be anywhere else, you say. America is your home. What?
I think it's the second to last sentence to say, I think I say something like, I've never even thought about it. You know, I don't want to be anywhere else. I never even thought about it. Well, of course, I've spent 360 pages thinking about it. So, but yes, I think at the end of the book, it's clear that this narrator and his consciousness and the cast of his being is fundamentally American. This narrator is, at least, you know, in the course of the book, making a case for himself as one of those people who can both be American but can operate as a kind of conscience for his fellow citizens, someone who can maybe reflect back some of the conundrums, the moral dilemmas that we must deal with if we are going to flourish.
But that affirmation of American identity, can we conflate you and your narrator here?
I think we probably can. I think we probably should. You know, I am American. I wouldn't know. I mean, if I lived somewhere else, I would feel only more American. I know that when I've lived in Europe, I was really not Parisian. I was really not German. I was American.
Something you couldn't have anticipated is that your book would be published during the time of a global pandemic and one that's caused so much pain in the United States.
Indeed.
How does that color or maybe sharpen your view of what's going on in your country today?
Well, I think that I worried before the book came out that the portrait I was painting of a country in disrepair and widespread disrepair and sort of morally foundering was one that only some would be able to identify with. But clearly, since the pandemic and the chaos and disarray that and the rot, really, the sort of institutional rot that has been laid bare so clearly, I think it's a lot easier for folks to inhabit the book and recognize the country that the narrator is showing them. And I think that if anything, the pandemic has made the book's case that much more urgent and that much clearer.
You've said that writing this book changed something inside of you, something that you didn't know needed changing or were yearning to change. What's different now?
Hard to articulate. It's a feeling of something settled, something secured, which was long adrift or long bound to the core in some makeshift way. but now seems to have become integrated to the center. It's part of me, whatever this is. And I, you know, I'm grateful for that. I didn't know that a book could do that, but I'm grateful that, and hopefully it'll last. We'll see.
It's really a pleasure to have the chance to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. This is it's a pleasure and an honor.
Playwright and novelist Ead Akhtar at his home in New York in 2020. Homeland Elegies is available in paperback from Little Brown. Akhtar's plays, Disgraced and Junk, are also available in paperback. Akhtar is the current president of the American branch of PEN, the international human rights organization that champions freedom of expression for writers. Writers and Company is produced by Sandra Rabinovich, who is also senior producer. Melissa Gismondi is associate producer. I'm Eleanor Wachtel. Next week, from Nigeria, Ayobami Adebayo. She made a stunning debut with her novel Stay With Me. Her new book, A Spell of Good Things, is a study of power, politics, and poverty in modern Nigeria through the stories of two very different families. That's next week. I hope you'll join me.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.